We are going to go to an interview that I did with Edward Hammond from the Sunshine Project, and they are an organization which monitors biowarfare around the world. They have an office in Austin, Texas, and in Germany. And we're just going to discuss a little bit about how, sort of the way the trend of biowarfare, where it's going, and then I'm going to discuss a little bit afterwards about bird flu and perhaps some of the people that may be profiting from that. So stay with Friday Morning After. It's 8:13. I'm Joe with Sarah in the studio. And we'll be back in about 18 minutes after this interview.
Okay, I'm Joe Broadhurst. You're listening to CKUT Radio in Montreal, Quebec. I'm pleased to be joined on the phone with Edward Hammond from the Sunshine Project. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
I am particularly interested in this organization. Can you give me a background on when you started it and what you guys are doing?
Sure. The Sunshine Project started in the end of 1999, and we work on biological weapons control. We have an office in Austin, Texas, in the U.S., and in Hamburg, Germany. And basically, we're a small, international, non-governmental organization that tries to play a progressive role in international negotiations on biological weapons, and we do quite a bit of original research using freedom of information laws and other ways to try to gather information about biodefense programs and some other kinds of biomedical research.
From your point of view, what is the state of bioweaponry in the United States? I know that President Nixon had cut off offensive bioweaponry. Is that correct?
In 1969, President Nixon renounced offensive biological warfare, and in the 70s, it was prohibited internationally by the Biological Weapons Convention. Of course, the Biological Weapons Convention, which bans all kinds of biological weapons, was violated by the former Soviet Union and also by Iraq in the 80s, although those programs ceased to exist long before the second invasion. In the United States, the offensive program was converted into a defensive one, and it continued at a relatively low level through the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. Beginning in the late 90s, and especially after 2001, the program has gone from being one that cost roughly $700 million a year to being a gigantic gold rush, which is now in the neighborhood of $7 to $8 billion per year. And when you look at the expansion of the program, the important aspect to bear in mind is that a lot of biodefense research, particularly that related to evaluating the pathogenicity of organisms or to assessing threats, is very difficult to distinguish from offense. And a lot of people, myself included, believe that there are areas of the biodefense program that have veered out of legitimate defensive activities and into things that certainly cause more threat than they could potentially solve.
Is there a possibility that in some of these cases things just leak out? Is that correct?
One of the aspects of the growth of the program is that there are dozens and dozens of new high containment facilities being built in the United States. These are facilities called biosafety level 3 or level 4, and basically they're places where diseases that are difficult to treat or impossible to treat are studied. And so these laboratories do not have a perfect safety record, and sometimes things do escape. And in fact, because the expansion is at an unprecedented scale, there are a lot of concerns that we're going to see a man-made epidemic because of a problem in a lab.
Did you monitor the situation in New Orleans as far as there was a biocontainment lab, I believe, at the University of Tulane? Is that correct?
Correct. There were labs at Louisiana State University Health Science Center in New Orleans, at Tulane. The state of Louisiana also had a lab. And that was an unsettling situation, I think, because what appears to have happened is that basically they locked the door and walked away, at least at Tulane and at Louisiana State. In the case of the lab that belonged to the state of Louisiana, actually the lab director grabbed some state policemen and they broke into their own facility and destroyed all of the dangerous bugs. But that, as the city was flooding, but that did not happen in the case of the other labs. And apparently those labs were basically left unattended for a number of days, if not maybe weeks, with potentially very dangerous cultures inside them.
Has anybody done any testing to see if people were directly affected by any of those things?
I think that if something had happened, we would know. And to my knowledge, that didn't happen. I think that the more worrisome thing from my perspective is that if you had somebody who was intent upon using a biological weapon and who was reasonably intelligent, which I believe that some people are, certainly the message that was broadcast by the really messy situation in New Orleans is that that would be a particularly opportune time to try to acquire different samples of diseases. If you have a natural disaster and basically the people responsible for these facilities just walk away, which is what happened.
The anthrax attacks that happened after 2001, those were anthrax spores that were military grade and made in the United States. Is that correct?
Almost certainly correct. The strain that was used was only possessed by a few labs in the U.S., and I believe one in Canada and one in the U.K. And, of course, the predominant theory is that, and the genetics basically say that it's a virtual certainty that the strain was obtained in a U.S. military lab.
I want to ask you about bird flu specifically because we have been flooded with information revolving the impacts of bird flu and or the potential impacts of a pandemic, they're calling it, in the United States. And they are warning schools and people are making large amounts of money in the field of vaccines and et cetera. Can you tell me a little bit about how this whole operation works, because we have these bio containment labs all around the United States in different universities and at different military establishments. And can you just tell me how that situation works, where they create viruses and then they create vaccines, and how that works and who makes money?
Sure. Well, the area of influenza flu research that the Sunshine Project has focused on has been the recreation of 1918 Spanish flu. That flu killed tens of millions of people around the world. It was a truly devastating outbreak of influenza. As it happens, some of the people that have been involved in the recreation of 1918 flu, which we see as being completely unjustified, because basically you are creating an otherwise completely dead organism that poses a threat to nobody. Well, now it does pose a threat because it exists in laboratories.
There was no sign of that flu for 80 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. Basically, 1918 flu disappeared a few years after it appeared. It mutated into something else, or the strain simply died out in places. So the resurrection of 1918 flu was a very disturbing event, in my opinion, because here you had science basically creating a bug that otherwise was non-existent, and which, frankly, in the event of a lab accident, could literally kill millions of people, and that is not hyperbole.
What was their official explanation for doing that?
Well, the official explanation is that it helps prepare for flu pandemics. Of course, the problem is that 1918 influenza is a very, very different bug than H5N1 influenza, which is the bird flu that we're talking about potentially coming into North America really any time now. They are radically different types of flu. And so studies of 1918 influenza don't significantly inform about the behaviors of its distant cousin, which is the one that we're dealing with now. Now, some of the laboratories that are pushing the development of this technology to create, and in this case, you know, deliberately create new kinds of pandemic influenza, also have patent rights and intellectual property over the processes to develop flu vaccines. So, sort of ironically or a little bit repulsively from my perspective, some of the folks that are creating these new threats in the laboratory are also in a position to profit rather handsomely from bird flu vaccines. And basically it's because you have two groups that have developed technologies that enable you to basically build any influenza virus you want in the lab.
Who are those two groups?
One is based at the University of Wisconsin and has done some work there, and at the Canadian BSL-4 in Winnipeg. That's the BioSafety Level 4 lab that belongs to the Canadian government. The other is based at St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, and Mount Sinai Medical School in New York City. And those are the two competing intellectual property portfolios for making influenza vaccines now.
And they are going to they profit heavily from something like that? Is that correct?
Well, I mean, certainly it remains to be seen how valuable it's going to be. Traditionally, influenza vaccines were made in a different way, and now these new techniques, which are called reverse genetic engineering, are coming in onto the market. So the ultimate value of the patents is unclear, but certainly if H5N1 were to go global and to become a disease of humans, right now it remains largely a disease of animals, then presumably the value would be tremendous.
At the University of Wisconsin, there exists a Dr. Yoshihiro Kawaoka. Are you familiar with him?
Correct. Dr. Kawaoka is the lead researcher of one of the reverse genetic engineering approaches with influenza. He's done work both to create types of influenza with 1918 genes. He's also doing genetic engineering experiments with the Ebola virus.
And he's trying to create vaccines for the Ebola virus, is that correct?
The immediate intent, according to what I've seen with the Ebola work, is to create potentially a strain that is a little bit easier to handle in the laboratory, because it is a very dangerous bug. Of course, the problem is that whenever you start genetically tinkering with bugs like that, the results can be rather unpredictable, which has been, you know, demonstrated rather dramatically a couple of times in recent years.
I want to ask you a question, because the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where he operates, is on a list on your website, the sunshine-project.org, as listed as a biocontainment. There's a biocontainment unit there, or a laboratory. Is that correct statement?
Yes. The map that you refer to, which is on the website, depicts all of the high containment, the level 3 or level 4 facilities in the United States that are significantly dedicated to work on biological weapons agents that we're aware of.
I have gone back and followed several of his papers, and they all seem to be funded by the American, the U.S. Army Institute of Pathology. Is that something that you've seen?
A significant amount of the work on 1918 influenza has been funded by the Army Institute of Pathology, or conducted by them. You see, what happened is that the Army actually developed a technique for rescuing genes from archival samples. So they were able to, for example, literally, in the case of 1918 influenza, they dug up an Inuit woman from permafrost in Alaska who had died of the 1918 bug, recovered some dead genetic material from her body, and then were able to piece the influenza virus back together from that. That's a technology that was developed by the U.S. military. So they have been intimately involved in the projects to recreate 1918 flu. Ironically, that technology was not developed for any compelling reason related to influenza research. They developed the technology, and then they said, well, what would be scientifically cool or interesting to do, and then set about recreating this bug. So it was a technology in search of an application, not a technology that was developed because it was driven by any public health concern.
It would also seem to be, or it has the possibility of being used as an offensive biowarfare, no?
Sure. I mean, a lot of these kinds of technologies that relate to potentially altering the pathogenicity or creating new kinds of viruses or bacteria, but especially the viruses, have really significant applicability to creating weapons if that's what you want to do. The problem in the U.S. biodefense program comes from situations where now a lot of, in my estimation, you know, a number of the leaders of the biodefense program have sort of thrown out the old rule book. And now they sort of say, well, you know, it might be possible to do this kind of genetic transformation of a bug, and that might make the bug a lot more dangerous. So let's do it and see what happens. And that kind of reasoning is leading us into a very bad place in terms of the biodefense program. And if you look at it from outside of the United States, of course, there are a lot of countries that have a lot to fear from the U.S., and they don't necessarily think that the U.S. is up to good things if it's doing things like recreating dead pandemic bugs that kill millions of people.
On March 15th, you had issued a press release, and you stated that the U.S. House votes to advance offensive biological weapons plan. Can you just tell my listeners a little bit about that before we go?
Sure. This is an idea that's been floating around for a long time that simply will not die. A group of people in the U.S., it really originated with the CIA in the 1970s, has been promoting the idea to use a biological agent to try to eradicate marijuana, coca, or opium poppy, the source of drugs. The problem lies in that they're trying to force other countries like Afghanistan or Colombia to use these biological agents. And in those countries, you have really a state of war. And in effect, the idea to use these funguses or these fungi to eradicate the crops is a violation of the Biological Weapons Convention. And in not in so many words, but in essence, that was admitted by Bill Clinton shortly before he left office when he killed the program. Now it's coming back again, and we're not confident that the Bush administration is going to be quite as aggressive in tamping it down.
Okay. I've been joined by Edward Hammond, and are you a director?
That's correct.
Director of the Sunshine Project, and you can find them online, sunshine-project.org. And you can also there's an abundant amount of information, and this is the kind of organization that we need to follow what these people are doing. And I thank you for joining me this afternoon, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Great. Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Friday Morning After. I'm Joe Broadhurst. It is 8:31. I just have a couple of follow-up things to say about that interview. I did that interview about 3 weeks ago. And since then, there's been a big push for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation, and that's all fine and good, but we need to pay attention to exactly what's going on here. And as you may have heard in that interview, which I did, and that was with Edward Hammond of the Sunshine Project, you can find them at sunshine-project.org. And there's lots of information on that site, but if you do some research and you start looking into the bird flu virus, you can find out that, as you may have heard, a certain doctor Kawaoka, who is based out of the University of Wisconsin, and who was funded by the United States Army Institute of Pathology, generated bird flu in 2001. Specific things to say out of that article that was published. It was actually called "Generation of a Highly Pathogenic Avian Influenza A Virus from an Avirulent Field Isolate by Passaging in Chickens." And part of that is to investigate whether this mechanism could apply to wild waterfowl. We studied an avirulent wild swan virus that replicates poorly in chickens, and so they manipulated that virus so that it eventually had a very widespread effect on chickens. These results demonstrate that avirulent virus is maintained in wild waterfowl in nature, and bearing the consensus avirulence type sequence RETR, have the potential to become highly pathogenic while circulating in chickens. That was in 2001. We have another article from 1999, generation of influenza A viruses entirely from cloned cDNAs. There's proof that the United States Army was funding research in order to create a bird flu virus in 1999 and 2001. We also have Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who is currently worth about $175 million. In 2002, he sold stock in several different companies worth about $90 million. One of those companies is Gilead, and Gilead is responsible for a drug called Tamiflu, and Tamiflu is the drug that the government has said will be used to fight against bird flu. And it just so happens that on March 22nd, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld makes $5 million from selling his some stock in Gilead. While there's no definitive proof that we would say that the U.S. Army has created bird flu and sent it out as a biowarfare weapon, there's certain things to question there. Who is profiting? And certainly Dr. Kawaoka, who worked on that and was funded by the U.S. Army. The head of the U.S. Army is making millions of dollars from Tamiflu with his company Gilead. So there's just something to question there. We don't have any definitive proof, obviously. We're going to go to some music, and we're going to come back, and we're going to speak with Mary Etheridge, and she is an independent reporter covering Palestinian issues. Stay with us.